Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
All right, in business school, I learned when you get GDP contractions two quarters in a row, that's a recession. Now people are telling me, not so fast. We've got a strong consumer. We've got everybody's kind of got a job if they want one. The wages are going up a little bit. I don't know. But let's bring in somebody who does this for a living, Russell Price. He's a chief economist. He used to have a real job as an equity research analyst. We'll get to that in a minute. But now he's going over to
the
dark side.
We should point out that Bloomberg Financial has picked him as the best. One of the best, one of the most accurate economic forecasters in our benchmark consensus survey.
Yeah, and he's at Ameriprise Financial. And most importantly, he joins us live here in a Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. So, Russell, the economy, I know we've got a lot of headwinds out there. And I know we've got some GDP data that suggests we're in a recession. But some people are telling me not so fast. How do you think about it?
You know, I think it's much more important just to look at the overall data rather than trying to label it, whether it's a recession or not a recession. Either way you look at it, the economy is it's slowed down and is likely to slow further. So I think we'll probably be right around the break-even point for a couple of quarters. We could slip into portions where consumer activity and business investment spending are actually negative. They haven't been there quite yet. Consumers are very strong. So I think it's really based on the numbers. We're not in a recession yet, but we could yet still be.
It, you know, to me, it's highlighted the difference in real and nominal GDP. So my whole life, we've focused on real GDP, but apparently in my dad's day, you know, they focused on nominal GDP. And I realized that the distinction is elementary. It's just inflation. But you can also interpret nominal GDP growth to mean, you know, we have an incredible amount of demand here. You know, Paul and I have been hearing all year that this inflation is all caused by the supply side and the Fed can't do anything about it. And lately, economists have been telling us, you know, maybe this still strong nominal growth means that there's a pretty big demand component to this inflation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think demand is very strong. It goes to show just how strong it is that the real consumer spending data in the GDP report has still been positive. So in other words, what that means is consumers are spending above and beyond the increase in prices that they're experiencing via inflation. So again, it goes to show just how strong consumers are. And
I always spend as much as I can.
Yeah.
Usually about 20 to 25% more than I earn.
That's your strategy?
Yeah, that's my rule.
Personal financial.
Well, look, you know, Mary Daly at the San Francisco Fed the other day, I think she was in an interview with Reuters. She said, I don't feel the pain of inflation anymore. This is a direct quote, by the way, Paul.
Okay.
She said, I see prices rising, but I have enough that I can make substitutions. I can do things. You know, she's saying she makes enough. But of course, she gets paid $422,000. And then has some pretty good investments as well. Are there people in this country who are really being hit hard and hurt by inflation?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. The people that spend the bulk of their or income on daily necessities, and certainly for housing, for rent, and certainly for gasoline and household utilities. Household utilities is kind of a under-the-radar inflation component because it's been going up at a strong pace and is likely to go up even further because natural gas prices are rising. And about 38% of the United States households electricity is generated via natural gas. So no matter how you heat your home coming in the winter, it's still going to be a higher price, and that's going to squeeze people still yet.
I tell you, this is going to be a huge story, Matt, in Europe coming up with this energy. I mean, we got to stay on top of it.
You don't even have to wait till winter. My electric bill last month was $1,500, electric and gas together.
But if you were in Berlin, like you were recently, it's going to be really ugly coming up this winter.
And, well, and if Berliners had air conditioners, it would already be bad.
That's right.
But they choose not to live well.
That's right. Russell, talk to us about the jobs market. We're going to get a big data point tomorrow. We had jobless claims came in, in line today, but, you know, showing some pickup in jobless claims. How do you think about the labor market?
Yeah, I think there's pockets where we are seeing some actual layoffs, but they're still a relatively modest overall pocket. I don't think we're seeing broad scale cuts by any means, but we are seeing a slowdown in the pace of hiring. That was evidenced with the other day, the JOLTS report. So I think that we're going to slow down for the month of July when it's reported. Well, I'm looking for a gain of about 240,000. I do expect the unemployment rate to tick down to 3.5% because the household survey has been flat for a few months, and I think we'll get a little bit of a gain there, which could momentarily drop the unemployment rate, but I think it'll probably rise slightly over the second half.
And so that gives the Fed basically more ammunition to raise rates. Jim Bullard yesterday said he wants to see the Fed rates at the end of this year at 3.75 to 4. And we're hearing people forecasting terminal rates at 5 to 6. They were outliers, but that group is getting bigger and bigger. Is that what you think as well?
No, we think that the terminal rate will probably be around somewhere between 3.5 and 4. So we're a little bit more optimistic.
And then what? Pause, or do they go back down?
I think a pause. I think the pause will be a period of time. I don't think they'll next year. I do not expect them to start to cut once again. But I think over the second half of the year, we will start to see inflation data more broadly. We're already seeing in commodities and lumber prices, things like that. We're already seeing apparel, things like that. We're already seeing those declines, but we need to see it more broadly in the CPI and PCE numbers. And I think by the end of the year, we are going to be seeing that with a couple of months under our belt.
All right, Russell. Great stuff. Thanks very much for coming in. Russell Price, Chief Economist for Ameriprise Financial, based in Troy, Michigan, which is a very nice burb of Detroit. And Russell was just giving us a little bit of an upbeat outlook for those Detroit Lions coming out. So go figure that.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring, when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Right now, let's get back to these markets here. The S&P off just slightly, off about 0.2%. We want to bring in Sean Snyder. He's head of investment strategy at Citi U.S. Wealth Management. Sean, I mean, boy, we had the S&P off, you know, a little more than 20% and its nadir. We had the NASDAQ off a little bit, but more than 30%. But boy, they've bounced back pretty well. And I guess the question that we ask a lot is simply, and I'm sure you're hearing from your clients, is this bounce back for real or is this just a head fake? What do you think?
First off, good morning. Thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it. Listen, I think there's a solid reason why the markets are up since mid-June. You have better than expected earnings. You have increasing confidence that inflation is maybe finally peaked. I know we've been a little bit like the boy who cried wolf with peak inflation, but it looks like it might actually be here this time. You have a noticeable decline in treasury yields. You know, tech stocks were reacting to rising treasury yields, and now they're reacting to them on the way down as well. And then you have the potential for a less aggressive Fed. So I do think that makes sense for markets to move higher. Now, the real question to me is, you know, is the bottom in? And to me, that really depends upon whether we have a recession or not. And I think this idea that we've already seen the worst may be wrong. If you ask yourself, you know, recessions tend to last about 11 months on average. Unemployment rate tends to rise by about 2.6% when you have a recession. Are stocks appropriately priced right now for that type of environment? I would argue maybe not, but it's going to take some time for this to play out, and we have to see what the Fed does, and monetary policy operates with a lag. So we have to see what happens to economic data in 2023. And I think this is just going to be one of those times where we have to be really patient as investors.
What do you think QT means? I mean, when do we start it in earnest and how much does that tighten up financial conditions? Because they've just gotten looser over the past few weeks.
Well, that's right. So with the stock market actually going up, that loosens financial conditions, and financial conditions are about as loose as they were back in March. So in some regards, that actually makes the Fed's job a bit more difficult and would actually argue for them to continue to tighten, even though they may wish to kind of pivot at some point. So that does make things difficult. You know, really is a question about 2023. You know, we head into 2023, inflation is on a downtrend, the economy's holding up. You know, I think the Fed can maybe dial back a little bit, hope that things are, you know, on track for that soft landing. But, you know, it's really going to be difficult if core inflation doesn't start to come down, if shelter prices stay elevated, we continue to see wage growth. And I think the Fed may feel that it has to continue to raise rates into 2023. And I think it's going to be a really interesting story in 2023 because these dual mandates will become dueling mandates, where what does the Fed do at that point if unemployment is rising while inflation is staying hot, you know, hotter than hoped for? Which one takes precedence? And that could add to market volatility. We'll have to wait and see.
Sean, we're about 80% of the way through earnings season in terms of the S&P 500 here. A little bit better than expected, I think. What are your takeaways?
It is better than expected. I think we were expecting about 5.5% EPS growth year on year. It's tracking above that full percentage point, probably 6.5-7%. So that's certainly good. My takeaway from earnings and the economic data that we're seeing this week, I know the market rallied on an uptick in the ISM services index, is that to me, it's telling us that we're not in a recession yet. It doesn't confirm to me that one will ultimately be avoided. So I still think I'm being a bit cautious here. But so far, I think the economy is holding up okay. We're continuing to see job growth. I think we'll see that again tomorrow. And I think that's positive news and kind of gives the Fed the green light to, you know, tighten a bit more. But, you know, getting towards the end of 2022, I think it might be a bit more difficult.
Sorry, we've heard that a lot of people are holding cash. Is that the case for you and your clients as well?
Some of our clients may be holding cash, but as a, you know, firm, our global investment committee is fully invested. We're defensively positioned, so we're in areas like dividend growers, healthcare, consumer staples. We also like natural resource stocks. We think that's kind of an inflation hedge. And then, you know, certain pockets of fixed income, U.S. municipals, intermediate duration, investment grade credit. We're basically looking for pockets of opportunity rather than sitting in cash. And, you know, the problem with sitting in cash is in an inflationary environment, if inflation is running at 9.1% and you're in cash, that means you're losing 9.1%. At least if you're in equities, you know, you get some sort of dividend yield, or fixed income, you get some sort of dividend. So I think there's better alternatives. And we really do think bonds are back. We think we saw the peak in yields probably earlier this year. So we think fixed income, you know, presents an opportunity here that's at least better than sitting in cash.
All right, Sean, good stuff. Really appreciate getting a few minutes of your time. Sean Snyder, he's head of investment strategy at this little bank in New York City called Citi, the U.S. wealth management side of that business here. So bonds are back, so says Mr. Snyder, and they are fully invested there at Citi. Vince Signorella, he's global macro strategist for Bloomberg News. Traded currencies back in the day, traded bonds back in the day. Now he is firmly ensconced in his work from home office setup, which he has set up like no one else. He doesn't need anybody because he's just done it all. And we love it when he checks in because he has some very interesting calls on these markets. Vince, I know you've been, the way I phrase it to people is Vince Signorella's got a very positive kind of view on risk assets. And boy, for the last couple months, you've been so spot on there. And I think it was kind of predicated upon the Fed's not going to raise as much as people think. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I feel very strongly that way. I mean, I've
still,
you know, as you guys probably remember, back from, I've been a Fed watcher since my college days. I traded through Volcker. I met Paul Volcker. This is not Volcker's inflation that we're fighting. you know, the consumer's getting tapped out. Revolving credits at up 13% this year, wages up 5%, inflation's up 9%. It's not keeping chasing their tail a little bit. They made a huge error with their transient call. They're trying to correct that, save some credibility. And I'm afraid they're just going to make another policy mistake because the consumer is going to taper going into the third and fourth quarter. So demand is going to drop to meet supply. We're not going to get this runaway inflation the Fed seems to think that's going to continue. It's already starting to roll over.
Dude.
And when that happens, I think equities, especially the NASDAQ and the tech sector, are going to rock. And the short end of the treasury curve is going to be brilliant because when those expectations drop, those bonds are going to soar. They're up to levels where they see inflation at 3-odd percent,
yeah,
or rates at 3-odd percent.
You need to get on a conference call with the bond market, man, because or Zoltan Pozsar, because, you know, it seems like that narrative of the Fed, you know, going to 3.5 or 4 and then cutting in like even the first half of 2023 has been flipped on its head over the last week. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's talking about 5% for a terminal rate, even 6. And those who are more conservative still think that the Fed is at least going to pause for the year and not cut.
Well, I'm not so sure they're going to cut necessarily. You know, I mean, let's face it, if they raise rates to 3 to 3.5%, and you have inflation coming down, inflation is not going to come down to 3 to 3.5% by year end. So they're perfectly, you know, in a situation to stay where they are and pause. But I mean, let's look at the yield curve. The 10-year yield is not pricing in 5-6% Fed interest rates or maintaining inflation with 38 basis points inverted from the twos. The twos are pricing in 3 to 3.5% Feds with being just over 3%. But the rest of the curve inverted for a reason that the bond market doesn't believe this trend for past this year is going to continue very much.
So what I haven't heard recently is stagflation. That was kind of a thing that I had to go back into my little textbook and check it out. But we haven't been talking about that much recently.
Well, you know, the reason, again, when I say this isn't Volcker's inflation, I sat in those gas lines with the odd and even license plates.
What car were you driving back then, Vince?
Oh, man, it was a 1971 Buick LeSabre that got 11 miles to the gas.
Nice.
I was in those gas lines a lot. I was in those gas lines a lot. The reason why we had that, and hopefully the Inflation Reduction Act won't repeat this, is the White House and Nixon administration imposed price controls, and they thought that they could put a cap on prices and therefore cap inflation. But what they did, it wasn't across the board. So, for instance, you had a cap on beef prices to keep, you know, meat prices down for the consumer, but they didn't cap the grain prices for the ranchers. So they could no longer raise cattle at a profit, so they stopped. And what happened? Prices went through the roof because of the supply-demand issue. So unless the administration makes the same foolish mistake as they did in the 70s, this isn't that kind of inflation. The demand will slow. It will come back to balance. We're already starting to...
By the way, that's an interesting point, Vince. You know, so many people at the... well, for the last, you know, 6 months have been saying this is all about the supply side and the Fed can't do anything about it. And then I heard, I believe Paul and Tom were talking to Michael Darda a couple days ago, and he said, look, nominal growth is really high. And to me, that signals that demand is a huge part of the problem. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, but I think it's going to slow. I mean, we saw mortgage rates today drop below 5% for the first time in April. You know, the housing market's beginning to slow, and that's where I think the, you know, what people miss is the consumer's real wealth is in their homes these days. Most of them aren't invested in the stock market. So if prices start to come down, or we're starting to see in the real estate market here in the Northeast, what we're seeing is sales decline. So we're not really seeing prices come down yet, but we're starting to see a decline in sales. Naturally, what will follow is a decline in prices. And when the U.S. consumer sees that, and they see that their wages aren't keeping up with inflation, I mean, no one's getting a 9-10% raise this year to to keep up with that pace. And it's likely going to be pretty high next year as well. So at some point, when you see revolving credit up 13% on in a year, that's a consumer that's really tapped out. And I just don't see that as lasting for a very, very long time.
Vince, you know, here at Bloomberg Radio and TV, we make a big day out of Jobs Day and tomorrow's Jobs Day. What are you looking for? What do you
think? It's the granddaddy of all economic statistics.
Exactly. That's how you guys play it. I'm in. I'm all in. What are you looking for, Vince?
Well, see, this is the thing, and I disagree once again with the majority opinion on this. The jobs numbers will definitely begin to slow. And that's because they're a lagging indicator. And when I keep seeing the Fed talk about a strong job market, I want to go back and like throw my economic textbooks at somebody, because we are going to see jobs slow, but it's going to lag the rest of the economy. Inevitably, we're starting to see the job cuts are left and right from some of the major corporations. There was an announcement again this morning of another major corporation cutting jobs. It is going to slow. Mm-hmm. And my fear is that the Fed is walking into some kind of like a bear trap where they're going to raise rates, you know, low, but job slowing being a lagging indicator, it's already going to be too late. The economy's going to roll over.
Right. All right, Vince, good stuff as always. We got the bullish call on stocks and risk assets. He's been consistently making that call for the last couple of months there, and he's been right. So,
by the way,
he's sticking with it. He's, you know, no waver in that voice.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You you know, some of the news that's coming across the tape over the last few days just kind of makes me chuckle a little bit coming out of Wall Street, because it just seems like it was just weeks/months ago that we were seeing stories about how Wall Street couldn't hire people fast enough, and they couldn't pay their incoming analysts and associates enough, and raising salaries every other week.
It seemed you were asking every banker that came on the show, like, did you go into your manager's office and demand
a double
bonus, you know?
And now we've got stories like the exact opposite. We're talking about cutting jobs, plunging bonus pools. I got to get to the bottom of this. We can do that with Hannah Levitt, finance reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us live. Yes, live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. We appreciate that. Hannah, what's going on Wall Street? I mean, I know it's a yo-yo ball, pay a lot, pay terrible, pay a lot. Where are we now, and what are the banks telling you?
Hey, yeah, thank you for having me. So it looks like bonuses, especially for the investment bankers, are set to be way down this year. And as you mentioned, last year was this, you know, crazy onslaught of deals and war for talent, and they couldn't, yep, you know, pay people enough and get enough people to, you know, work there and do their deals. And now the tides have clearly turned. There's been a massive slowdown. I think something like 40-some% drop in investment banking revenue at the big five banks, and you know, with that, the bonuses will not be what they were last year.
Yeah, I'm looking at MA Go right now, and I see that, you know, we're already in August, but it's only $2.3 trillion worth of total M&A, and a lot of that $1.1 trillion is pending, so who knows if it's going to actually happen. Why the big slowdown this year?
You know, I think it's actually really interesting if you look at it, and you look at how trading has been good, and it's the it's two sides of the same coin, right? Because there's been all this, you know, persistent inflation, recession fears, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, all these things that have led to a lot of, you know, market moves, market turmoil, uncertainty, and people don't want to do deals in that kind of uncertainty, and so it gets, you know, really on pause. But then on the flip side of that, you see the trading results have been up, and that'll be like kind of a lone bright spot bonus-wise. As of now, they're looking to be up a bit.
So, by the way, I just wanted just for clarity on what we saw last year, more than $5 trillion in deals in the full year. And even in the first COVID year of 2020, we saw $3.5 trillion. So we really need, well, we're not going to eclipse last year, and we're probably not going to even match 2020, which is insane, because that's when everybody had to work from home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the work from, I mean, tell us, you know, where is Wall Street on the work from home? Because we had so many different messages coming out of the big names, the big CEOs on Wall Street.
It was
got to
get
back in the office. Mm-hmm. Yeah. UBS saying no, and you know, saying no, you can, and Citi saying no, we'll be flexible. Mm-hmm. Kind of where, how's it evolved?
You know, it's interesting because if we had been having the same conversation a year ago, I could have spent, you know, 5-10 minutes walking through how each of the different firms was approaching it slightly differently, and, you know, some being more flexible than others. Really, it is not something that I even hear about from sources anymore. It's like they're, you know, they're in the office. Some are, you know, 5 days, some are 3 days. But the point is, like, it is what it is at this point, where it's kind of a non negotiable. I mean, people will be grumbling about it a little bit.
Right.
But,
Paul grumbles about it every day.
Yes, I do.
That's funny.
And David Solomon probably does too. But that doesn't change the fact that his bankers want flexibility.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I think something that'll be interesting to watch is, do the bankers and the people demanding flexibility still hold the chips when we're in recession, then there are job cuts and
good
things
point.
Like that.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see when, you know, if and when this economy does go into a recession, the balance of power, not just on Wall Street, but just across the economy, which had been decidedly in employees' favor, which is not the norm, I don't think.
Certainly not in the last 20, 30 years.
Right. And now if you go into recession, is that going to switch back and employers are going to be like, okay, kids, back in the office?
Well, you know, I think it's very different for bankers than it is for factory workers on the floor at Deere.
Sure.
Right? Because there still isn't enough stuff.
Yeah.
So we need them. We still need flight attendants. We still need, you know, all of those, the service people as well. But bankers, it seems like they're, you know, not as necessary anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, we were hearing about these crazy, like, multi-million dollar packages and stuff just, I mean, months ago. That was the state of affairs and, like, you know, everyone poaching everyone from everywhere, getting all these competing offers. And now it's
first year salaries are going up to 100, then 110, then 120.
Exactly. Like in the span of weeks or months. But now, I mean, clearly, you know, even during earnings, which was a couple of weeks ago, banks were talking about focusing on costs.
And yes.
When you're focusing on costs, that does not mean that.
Well, back in the day, focusing on costs meant the town car. That was the first thing to go. The town car home from work was the first thing to go. Are they still, is Wall Street still losing talent to private equity? It seems like those first year analysts come in and they barely are there and they're already being interviewing for some of these PE jobs.
Yeah,
or,
I mean.
Or crypto. Yeah. Yes.
Well, the PE, that's absolutely still a dynamic. I think crypto, maybe less so today versus a year ago or even a couple months ago. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, so it's interesting. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, headcount, that's one of the expenses, certainly the one that they can manage aggressively, both on the upside and the downside. So we'll see how that plays out. On Wall Street, Hannah Levitt, finance reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us with that reporting. Again, big, big changes on Wall Street. The profits engine there, a lot of it from the banking side, the new issuance side, both in equity and fixed income, as we've seen from the results from the big banks, you know, trailing where they were last year and even in 2020 as well. And so what do? You take a look at the cost line. Lots going on out in the world. Let's bring in our next guest, Mei-Mei Hu, CEO and co-founder of Vaxxinity. Vaxxinity is a publicly traded company, trades under the symbol VAXX on the NASDAQ. So as you punch that into your Bloomberg Professional Service. Mei-Mei, thanks so much for joining us here. I'd love for you to, if you would just kind of give us a quick overview of what you're doing at Vaxxinity right now.
Yeah, great to be here, Paul. So yeah, Vaxxinity is obviously a vaccine development company, and our mission is really to bring the efficiency of vaccines to chronic diseases. And we decided to use our technology to go after COVID as well, particularly a next generation COVID booster. Just to show the breadth and depth of the technology. But, you know, we want to bring convenient, impactful, transformative medicines to the world.
Well, and it looks like you've been very successful in doing that, certainly bringing them to the NASDAQ. I see that you've overseen the successful spinoff of five companies. Are they all in the same kind of biotech, biomedical arena?
They're all in the biopharmaceutical space. So the predecessors have been actually in Asia. So we spun off an animal health company, a vaccine company that vaccinates almost a quarter of the world's livestock, swine.
You got to be careful to say swine, right? We can't say pigs anymore ever since the problem in China. Is
yes.
that right? Yes.
Yeah. That's right. So, So it's all been in the same area, but mostly in Asia. And then the most recent one was Vaxxinity. And that was, you know, a combination of two predecessor companies, one focused on neurological diseases and the other one focused on COVID.
So what is, Mei-Mei, the what is a variant inclusive COVID booster?
You know, so when we were at the White House, Dr. Fauci basically said, we need something that is more universal, like, right? So next generation, we're looking at broader coverage, and that's kind of where ours comes in, and more durable. So you don't want to be going out getting boosters every 3 months. And we take what we call a multi-tope approach, and that means not just looking at the spike protein, we cover other epitopes on the virus so that you have broader both B and T cell coverage. And hopefully that means that it's more protective against Omicron and future emerging variants, whatever they may be.
Where are we in the timing here? Because I for one was just, and I think a lot, most people were just so impressed by the ability of the healthcare community to come up with these vaccines so quickly and have them be so effective. Just an extraordinary effort there over the last several years. Where are we in terms of getting to that next generation COVID treatment or, you know, pill kind of thing?
You know, it's funny. So I would echo you. It's been unprecedented. Next generation is in some ways trickier because you got to figure out where you want to improve, right? There are so many areas to improve. I think we're pretty close. And there are a number of other efforts. We ourselves are in a phase three pivotal trial of our compound called UV612 and on track to deliver a top line readout later this year. And if successful, you know, this study could support conditional approval of our vaccine in a whole bunch of jurisdictions. So I think lots of progress have been made. And I think ever since the first vaccines got on the market, people have been working on next generation ones. And again, we're focused on being able to address future variants, being durable, being able to be distributed to, you know, all over the world, because at the end of the day, this is a global problem. And also something that is interesting to me particularly is safety and tolerability. Right? I want to develop the vaccine that I give my loved ones, one that doesn't necessarily make you feel sick, one that, you know, you give your kids. So there's a bunch of stuff that everyone's working on, but we're looking at the next wave pretty soon.
How are, and surely it'll come, and we're thankful to people like you who are helping us combat it. COVID, though, not nearly as ugly a disease as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and you're also working on drugs or therapies to fight that. Where are you?
That's what really gets me going. I love it.
Yes.
So we have shown in a number of clinical trials in humans that our vaccine works to do what we want it to in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. We're starting a phase one in migraine patients, and we're also developing a vaccine against heart attack and stroke. So something that can lower cholesterol in folks. So the Alzheimer's program is, you know, entering its large scale trial. So we call it a phase 2B. We've already shown that it can, you know, get your body to develop antibodies against these toxic amyloid oligomers. We've shown that it can neutralize the target, and that in our, you know, last phase 2A study that we can slow the progression of decline. And now we got to show it on scale. So that study, once launched, will take, 18 months or so to complete. So that's exciting stuff.
That would be incredibly exciting, because if you've watched someone suffer from either disease, it's just so horrendous. And so many people do. And right now there's nothing, really nothing that can be done. So I think everyone is with you and hoping that you guys make some real progress there, Maymay.
Yeah, thank you. It is devastating. And the one that we recently announced, just non-human primate data, is against a target called PCSK9 for hypocholesterolemia, so folks with high cholesterol. Mm. You know, cardiovascular diseases are still the number one killer around the world. And if you can lower cholesterol, you can make it magnificently large impact.
So. All right, Maymay, thank you so much for joining us. Maymay Hu, CEO and co-founder of the company Vaccinity, a biotech company doing some important work there.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.